Samuel Peterson is an author, playwright, and an artist, and throughout his life he has fought two big battles, coming to terms with his gender identity and drug addiction. He's written a memoir that covers an intense 20-day period in his lifelong struggles. The book is Trunky, Transgender Junkie, and Samuel Peterson joins me in the studio now. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks, Frank.
So this book is set just a few years ago after a relapse, but it really is part of a very long story that began for you as a young man, your first addiction to sugar, you think.
That's right. Well, as a young girl. Yeah, absolutely.
That's right, because that's the other part of the story. So tell us about that young woman who became addicted to sugar.
Well, sure. I feel like I came out of the womb an addict, because my early memories are like watching those luridly colored Warner Brothers cartoons and chomping down box after box of like honeycomb cereal, you know, and secreting them away in my bedroom. And, you know, the behavior of the addict was always there.
So that's the start. It did lead to harder drugs along the way.
Yeah. Well, you know, when we were talking, I was thinking about the first time I took opiates, and I was actually a young woman. I was 12 years old. I'd gotten my first period, and it was quite painful, and I had been prescribed codeine for it. And I remember taking that codeine, and it was the most pleasurable, euphoric feel. I mean, I just couldn't even believe it. And it was an antidote of sorts, you know, right? Not just to the pain, but I think I carried a lot of pain around the experience of having a period, you know.
Were you also at that time struggling with your gender identity?
Well, I wasn't struggling, because I had capitulated to the fact that I was a girl very early on. I mean, I was born in 1960. The technology wasn't there. The language wasn't there. So I think, you know, I experienced this very early heartbreak of this is impossible. Mm. You know, I don't think I could even articulate it as I wanted to be a boy when I was a kid.
But you had a sense that this was not what you were?
Yes.
Yeah.
That's right. And I found the pressures of being female immensely burdensome and frustrating.
You grew up, you just outside of Washington, D.C., then eventually moved to D.C. for a while.
Right.
And then New York. So tell us about New York and what were your aspirations at that point?
Well, like every 20-year-old who moves to New York, you know, I was an artist and I was in a band and I wanted to do those things, you know. So I kind of migrated with a bunch of other like-minded artists from D.C., and we began to make music and art. And of course, this, as is often the case with my life, was derailed by drugs and alcohol very quickly.
At this point, also, you're identifying as a lesbian, a female,
yes,
and a lesbian, right?
Right.
So you're in a community now. And how safe did you feel in New York? I mean, were you able to sort of feel safe as an out lesbian, or were you out to the whole world, or just within a limited community?
I've always been very out,
yeah.
Whatever it was, I've always been very out. And so, yes, I was in a sort of LGBT community in the 80s. And this was during the Reagan years. So there was the AIDS crisis was happening. It was a particularly troubling time to be queer or to be gay. But that having been said, there's also an enormous amount of community and rallying and support. So,
and what about at this point? Are you in and out of rehab, or are you pretty much a full-time junkie at this point? What's going on with you in the band?
Well, you know, Frank, I think this is it's a sticky thing, because I also suffered from depression. Mm-hmm. And I think the gender stuff was you know, contributed to this sense of being isolated and a kind of darkness and hopelessness that, you know, the narrative of addiction loves. Like, the addiction loves this kind of story of isolation and separation from others. And it preys on the mind. And, you know, in that regard, it just made me want to use more.
Well, I'm going to take you out of your story for a moment and take a look at the bigger picture along those lines, because this is a country that is nominally quite wealthy and has all sorts of opportunities for education and for economic prosperity. And yet, We have the highest substance abuse rate of any country in the developed world. We have the highest suicide rate of any country, highest incarceration rate. So by all those markers, we're not even a developed country. And I wonder what you think, if you've given any thought to this, this very question of what it is that makes us so miserable and searching for these other answers. Maybe this narrative of isolation, pull myself up by my bootstraps, has something to do with it.
Right. Well, I think, you know, we're in this kind of late stage capitalism, and we've seen the result of this narrative, this idea that somehow we, you know, I grew up with this, like, I'm independent, I can do it all. And in fact, you know, my mother was, she was the head of a department in the CIA. So my own mother worked her way, pulled herself up by her bootstraps and achieved this kind of American dream. And so I saw that was happening. But as you say, you know, it has consequences. The truth is we're not separate. The truth is we need one another. And the truth is that I above all people, needed to have the support and love of community.
What about your family at this time? You're up in New York. Are you in touch with them?
Yes, in the way that a sociopathic drug addict is in communication with his family, you know.
So you're asking for money.
Yeah.
That's for sure. Well, what about that? Are they showing it? Are they saying, come back, look, you need help? I mean, how's that going back and forth?
I think, you know, from very early on, they were completely vexed by this child. But as you say, you know, I came from the land of plenty. I was in suburban white Virginia, Northern Virginia, you know, with parents who took us to the Smithsonian every weekend. I was well educated. I had, you know, I think my parents saw that I had the perfect life. But internally, I was just traumatized, you know. And I think nobody could know what was going on for this kid, right?
And you weren't able to express it.
No.
So it manifests in these other behaviors.
Right.
And so in the meantime, you're exploring art now in New York City. You're using drugs. But you're also becoming an advocate for LGBTQ rights.
Yeah.
Tell us about that decision, because that's a separate step. You don't have to take that step.
Well, I don't know that it is separate for me, Frank. As an artist, my work was always about, you know, sort of pushing boundaries of the body and of being an outsider, you know, and building community. I don't know if I'm making any sense here, but that was my activism and really still is. You know, my personal story is what I can bring to the table.
You were also fighting your own form of homophobia, having internalized homophobia.
Oh, my gosh, yeah.
And now you're an LGBTQ, you're living in a community, you're out, and yet there's a certain degree of self-loathing that comes from living in a society that's not fully accepting.
Right. And I think that was complicated by gender as well for me. I found masculine women to be extremely troubling. And uncomfortable, which is so funny. It's just there were a number of markers for me around my gender that I refused to see, and I was just rotten with internalized homophobia and transphobia. I would find out later as well.
Had you ever considered that possibility when it crossed your mind? How did it cross your mind, and what did you do with the thought that maybe I'm trans?
Right. Well, you know, I moved. Eventually, I ended up in Austin, Texas, and I worked for an LGBTQ lobby in Austin, Texas, which I don't recommend.
Why not?
It was just really hard work. Yeah. It's like doing that work here. I mean, here I am again, right?
Yeah. Oh, just because it's Texas.
it's Texas.
And now you're in North Carolina where
it's equally awesome. Yeah. Right. So I'm help me come back to the...
So we're talking about you confronting the idea that initially, you didn't talk about growing up in the 60s, trans is not even an option.
Right.
But it must have crossed your mind. So what were you thinking?
Right. So I'm working in this lobby, and we have trans people coming to see us and coming for help. And I was even producing drag king performances. So after work, I'm doing these productions with these, you know, women who are dressing as men. And the whole time I'm doing this, I'm so uncomfortable. And I cannot identify it. And I see I see women transitioning to male, and I think, why are you doing that? Have we not given you enough room to play with gender? Have we not, you know, in our culture, given you the opportunity to express that? Like, I had no idea what was going on.
Well, I want to find out when it was that it came to you that this is a possibility and how you confronted it when my conversation continues with Samuel Peterson, the author of the new book, Trunky, Transgender Junkie, a memoir of his time in Butner, North Carolina's Blackley Rehabilitation Facility. He's going to be reading from the book Friday at 7 o'clock at Scuppernong Books in Greensboro, also a release party for the book February 2nd at Flyleaf Books in Chapel Hill. And we'll talk more about it after this break on The State of Things. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio, talking with Samuel Peterson, an artist and a playwright and the author of the new memoir, Trunky, Transgender Junkie. So we talked about sort of getting to New York. Now, how do you come, and we talked about cycles of addiction, you're in and out of rehab, you're in a band up there, you're aspiring to be an artist and identifying as a lesbian. How do you get to North Carolina then? What brings you here?
What does bring me here? I was living in Austin, Texas. The long and short of it is I was just done with Austin. I was done with Austin, Texas, and I ended up here. I was in a spiritual community, actually, that kind of put its tendrils out here. So I had had some sober time. I had built a spiritual practice, and I came here a sober person, actually.
Did that spiritual practice in any way inform, I mean, is that still part of your life today, or is that a
Absolutely.
Step along the way?
Absolutely.
Yeah. What was it that you gained from that?
From my spiritual practice?
Yeah.
I think the full embodied understanding that, you know, for all this kind of awful stuff we've been talking about, and it's overwhelming, and it's devastating, and it seems like that's all there is. It's not all there is, that I have a very clear sense of my purpose in life. I have a very clear sense of I get a joy from helping others, and I try to be open to these kind of human interactions that I eschewed and avoided for so long.
So it's an opening to some aspects of yourself that had been suppressed and otherwise not fully expressed.
Yeah, and also I think just a connection with other people. Mm. Like I really don't. You know, again, we come back to this narrative, this ideology of pull yourself up by your bootstraps, you're an individual. My experience as a human on this planet is that is absolutely false, that we actually are all connected in so many ways, whether, you know, you regard that as a spiritual connection or just that we rely on one another to survive, to literally survive, you know.
So you're here, and we talked again about gender and you're not wanting to consider, or simply not considering the possibility of transitioning to male.
Right.
When did that occur to you, and when did that become a possibility for you?
Well, I think it's in the water here, Frank.
Yeah. Certainly in the bathrooms everywhere you go.
Well, it's not in the bathrooms anymore, is it? Yeah. So I come to sleepy little Carrboro Chapel Hill, and after having lived in New York and, you know, and been in these crazy gay scenes in these big cities, and this place was full of trans people. I was so surprised, but I don't know what happened except that I was sober for maybe 5 or 6 years, and I heard from a gender therapist later that a lot of her guys come to her at 5 or 6 years. So there's a kind of awakening that happens, a kind of, you know, you talk about really diving into the pain, you know, really embracing that journey and coming across the things that terrified me the most. And that was a big fear, you know, to be male.
And you faced that fear and made the transition. How was that process for you? Was there a sense of wanting to renege on this commitment? Do you want to step back and say, wait, no.
Well,
I mean, I know there's a point of no return. But
there's, I don't know. Is there a point of no return? That's an interesting question. My own experience is that once I had that epiphany, oh my God, I'm actually a man, and that I've spent my entire life, you know, sort of skirting, as you will, if you will, skirting the issue, that I knew in a molecular way that I needed to be on testosterone and I needed to, you know, do these other things. And as I began hormonal transition with testosterone, I mean, Frank, it is insane. the mind and the body going through this kind of, right. You know, it's a rock and a hard place. You're just back and forth and back. And it's depressing and it's crazy making. But through the worst of it, I always understood this is what I'm meant to be doing.
Yeah. And so you make the transition. As you say, you were sober for 5 years. At 10 years of sobriety, you decided to go back to school. You had already been to undergrad in New York. You didn't finish.
Right.
And now you're going to go back to UNC.
Right.
So tell us about that decision and what you hope to do.
Well, so I went to Durham Tech. Mm-hmm. And I did all the like remedial math courses because I spent my math time in high school rolling joints in the back room. I was that kid. So I go to Durham Tech, and then I got accepted into UNC. And just if I can rewind for a minute, you know, you asked me about transitioning here. What I want to say is that having come from New York to North Carolina, North Carolina defied my expectations as a Yankee and a Northerner. The people here embraced me. Mm-hmm. They held me. They have supported me emotionally, spiritually, financially, as I, you know, entered into this journey. Like people in my community in Chapel Hill and Carrboro didn't necessarily understand what I was going through, mm-hmm. but they wanted me to be happy. And they understood the value of having a happy, healthy person in their community. So
that was some time ago, we have to say.
Well, this is like 5 years ago, or 7 years ago.
So now you do the remedial work. You're going to go back to
I go to UNC.
Yeah,
and you know, as one is sober, one uncovers all the things that one has been avoiding, right? And one of the things that I had apparently been avoiding was a kind of perfectionism and ambition that I didn't know I had, and it. It manifested in, a lot of A student behavior, and which when you're in your 50s is exhausting.
Yeah. Well, it's not easy when you're in your 20s, but you've got the, yeah.
Right.
So you relapse.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, the old narrative came in. I began to experience exhaustion and physical pain, and the old story came back of like, well, anyone else in this kind of pain would take painkillers, you know, and I've taken them successfully. I'd had top surgery and I'd had a rotator cuff surgery sober, and I had managed to do that successfully. Well, I did that successfully because I was surrounded by sober people and friends who made sure that I wasn't going to do anything shady or tricky, you know. Here I was all in my head. I was in my ego and, you know, it's the old story. So I get prescribed painkillers, you know.
Yeah. Vicodin, right?
Right. Right.
And so then you're back on opioids. So what happens to you then at that point? Now, do you drop out or where are you now?
Well, I had a play that I was working on, F to M to Octopus, which was positioned to do pretty well. Like I had a theater in New York that was interested in it, and I had a great team that was working on me with a play at UNC, and I was in the middle of this relapse, so I'm absolutely insane. And pull me back in.
Well, that brings us, I guess that's going to take us to Butner, North Carolina, where you're finding these drugs now when you're having to do when you're going underground.
Right. Well, so I'm at UNC and I'm being this honors student and I'm doing my thesis and the play and blah, blah, blah. And meanwhile, the addict mind has been fully activated by the presence of drugs in my system. Like all that work that I've done starts to unravel. And I find myself scanning the room for people I might hit up for drugs or money or, you know. And when I was sober, those thoughts didn't occur to me. You know, I'm not scanning the room for marks. But it had flipped that switch. And I discovered people who were buying drugs and naturally joined up with them. And yes, and we would go to Butner, North Carolina to buy heroin.
And which is interesting because that ends up being the place where you do your rehab.
That's right.
So tell us about that transition and how you sort of came to the notion or how you came back to rehab and stopped or decided it was time to stop.
Well, I was married at the time and had the success. And my wife, you know, very justly asked me to leave the house. So I'm like, I have, within a matter of months, lost everything. Everything that took me, you know, a decade to build, I've lost it, which is the story of addiction, right? So I end up living on a sofa at a friend's house, and another friend of mine encouraged me to go to Butner. And I knew I was done. So she took me to Butner, and it is with no small irony that Butner is a one-stop shopping place, you know, that there's this economy of this market of drugs, yeah, crack and heroin, and there's this entire institution devoted to jail psychiatric treatment and rehab, you know.
What is it you think? I mean, and then, again, that's not the big city, Butner. That's kind of you know, it's a rural area, or not. And I mean, it is urban, but it's not.
Butner,
North Carolina. Yeah. Why Butner? Why not Durham? Why not Chapel Hill?
Well, I think there is some of that in Durham too. You know, but Butner has it's I think a poorer town, yeah, and it relies on this economy. Yeah. You know,
so tell us about your time there, because that's where you spend the book focuses on those basically 20 days of your rehab.
Yes.
Tell us why you decided to write this and about some of the stories that you.
Well, had. So I got to Butner, and they were, you know, they wondered where to put me because I'm transgender. They asked me where I wanted to be. And right. I said, well, I don't think that I would do well in the women's ward. You know, I'd like to be on the men's ward. And they were fantastic. I mean, they took such great care of me. And so I got my own room, which is unheard of. And, you know, Frank, I'm on a men's ward, a former female on the men's ward. I mean, I'm like the spy in the house of love, right? Except that there's not a lot of love, but but I recognize that this, you know, I have a unique vantage, and I got to critique the devastating ways in which masculinity keeps people sick and keeps people using, and, you know, keeps people in and out of these jails institutions and kills them.
Tell us more about that.
Well, you know, at the risk of sounding men are from Mars and women are from Venus, which is not what I subscribe to at all, these men were highly invested in maintaining the facade of masculinity. Mm-hmm. You know, addiction relies on being invulnerable, you know, mm-hmm, and also feeling deep shame. So... Mm-hmm. Here are these guys, they don't know how to be vulnerable. They're experiencing intense amount of shame and remorse and regret, none of which can really be expressed within the confines of masculinity, much less institutional masculinity, which is a whole, like, escalated breed of... Yeah.
But you're talking about, and it's a constructed masculinity.
Yeah. I mean,
it's a particular kind of cultural take on masculinity, yeah, that we have, I would say, in the United States, right? I mean, you're,
right,
talking about the American brand, which,
right,
is... independent, in control.
Yeah,
you know,
all the things we've been talking
kind of,
about.
Kind
yeah.
of things. Total lie.
Yeah.
Can't happen. And when you fail, you either, you know, sort of, then you take control through these other means or
right. and
the
so
pretense of control.
We're back to your conversation about what makes people reach out for drugs and alcohol, you know, which the, you know, the pressures on men to be masculine are, they're lethal. Yeah. They literally are lethal. So you fuel that with drugs and alcohol and, you know, crime, right, forget it. There were moments where this would crack and these guys would be so, so vulnerable and so honest. I mean, that's where the hope comes in. And that's where recovery can come in. So it was quite a remarkable journey.
What was it like for you? Because, again, you've been through some of this, at least the difficult journey within facing those demons and embracing things that had been pain and not pushing them away. You'd been through all of that.
Right.
How is this different for you? And obviously you're having these other deep reflections now on masculinity,
right,
that are not quite what you had had up until that point.
Yeah.
So tell us how this was different for you and this rehab was different for you.
Oh, gosh. Well, I truly knew that I was at the end of my rope. Like, if I had not ever felt like I would die before, I knew that this was my last rodeo. And it also, because I was there as a secret transgender person, the hypervigilance was exhausting. I mean, I was so vigilant and so terrified, and I felt soft and you know, insufficient, and so that just lent the whole thing a whole nother kind of flavor.
You got through it. You're sober now.
Yes, thank God.
And you're painting cats.
Yes.
Tell us about that. What are you doing?
Well, you know, I thought to myself, what would be the most ridiculous and completely opposite thing that I might do from Trunky? And yes, doing pet portraits is what I came up with.
This
it was thoughtful.
But in many, so you're doing pet portraits. Yeah. You're successful. What is this something? Because we talked about this before we went on. It's something you never imagined. And in fact, if you had said this is who you will become, you'd run away in horror.
Yes, yes, that's true. That, you know, and this is true about sobriety. That if I had imagined I would be someone who did yoga and drew, you know, people's dogs and cats, that I would run screaming down the street. But here it is, and here I am. And
is it making you happy? Is it good?
Yeah, I love it. I mean, who among us could not spend all day watching panda videos?
We're out of time. But how do you get them to sit still?
Well, I take pictures. I take photographs and work from photos because, yeah, great. It's impossible.
It's an amazing story, and I thank you for your honesty and for your willingness to share it with us. And in this book, Trunky, Transgender Junkie, the author is Samuel Peterson. He is the author of Trunky, Transgender Junkie. He's going to be reading from that book Friday at 7 o'clock, Scuppernong Books in Greensboro. Then there's a release party coming up February 2nd at Flyleaf Books in Chapel Hill. And if you missed it, all of it is on our website, stateofthings.org. Sam, thank you so much.
Good to talk with you. Thank you so much, Frank.
And good to talk with you on The State of Things. Thank you so much for listening to a program produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Charlie Shelton Ormond, Laura Pelliser. Robin Copley is our technical director. Brent Wolf is WUNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.